From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President-elect Donald Trump is in Indiana this afternoon to announce that Carrier Corporation will keep several hundred jobs in the state instead of moving them to Mexico. Then he's off to Cincinnati tonight for his first rally of a month-long tour to thank supporters in battleground states. Scott Detrow covers politics for NPR. He joins us with more on this and other political stories. Hi, Scott.
Hey, afternoon, Jeremy.
And what do we know about Trump's deal to save several hundred jobs at Carrier Corporation in Indiana? I know a lot of people have been looking into this and saying, you know, what incentives were given. And of course, not all the jobs are being saved.
That's right. We still don't officially know the details of this deal. That's something we asked about again on this morning's conference call with the Trump transition team. And they said that those details would be released in full, you know, during this press conference that's coming this afternoon. We do know from Carrier, they released a statement saying that they were persuaded for a variety of reasons, including a commitment to support the business community from the Trump administration. And this is a little more specific. Incentives offered by the state were an important consideration for them. Vice President-elect Mike Pence is, of course, still the governor of Indiana.
Right.
And we're hearing a lot of reports of tax breaks that were offered of different amounts. I think the other key thing, and you're seeing this in reports from Indiana news outlets, is that Carrier's parent company, United Technologies, has billions of dollars in federal contracts. And they were concerned that they didn't want to get on the wrong side of the incoming president when they do so much business with the federal government.
Hmm. What about the other big story this week involving Donald Trump? And that is his decision to, he says, separate himself completely from his business dealings. He promised yesterday on Twitter to do that.
Well, there's an interesting pattern in both of these stories in that the incoming Trump administration releases details, releases big headlines that are very positive for them. Trump saves 1,000 jobs in Indiana. Trump says he's going to separate for the business. But the details, which are very key, are not released. Trump says the details on his business separation is going to come in a couple weeks. So, you know, so that's 2 weeks of conversations without knowing the details. But I think this is the key thing. He is saying, as he settled along, that he's going to turn his businesses over to his children. But his children play a key role in his transition team. His children are top political advisors. And it looks by all indications that they will continue to be once he's president. If that's the case, it's really hard to have a separation between your business and your official work.
And of course, we'll find out more about this as he holds a press conference in the middle of this month. But what about the reaction, Scott, to some of Trump's picks for his cabinet? Wall Street insiders Steve Mnuchin and Wilbur Ross at the Treasury and Commerce departments are people who are kind of Trump's anti-establishment supporters. Happy with those choices?
I think it'll be really interesting to see the approval ratings and the reaction, especially if these picks kind of go forward with the policies they're talking about, which are really the standard policies that upset a lot of Trump supporters to begin with. You know, Trump talked so much about draining the swamp in Washington, especially over the last month of his campaign as he kind of rose in the polls. But right now, his incoming cabinet looks a lot like that swamp, if you want to phrase it that way. By that, I mean it's a lot of people with Wall Street ties, and it's a lot of longtime Washington insiders. This is kind of a cast of characters that you would see in most Republican administrations in terms of the people he's talking to.
And no Democrats in the cabinet yet, and that's something that presidents often do, even if it's kind of just one person, but they do that. I know that Donald Trump is meeting with North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp, who's a Democrat. That's happening tomorrow. What do we know about whether he's going to put a Democrat in?
We're not sure what exactly they're meeting about. This was asked about this morning, and a spokesman, Jason Miller, said, you know, there's two kinds of meetings. There's people that Trump just wants to talk to, and there's people he's interviewing for jobs, and he did not say which one that would be. Heitkamp would be an interesting pick because she is up for re-election in a couple of years. And here we are talking about the next election already.
Oh, no.
And she's a Democrat in a Republican-leading state. So that would be maybe a sneaky way to pick off a seat in the Senate 2 years from now, which is already looking like it's going to be another tough election for Democrats just based on the states where Senate seats are up.
Just about 30 seconds left here, Scott. But what about these rallies that Trump is going to be holding? There's going to be one tonight in Cincinnati. Why hold rallies like that after the election?
It's not something that's usually done. And I think it's going to be something to pay close attention to because we've seen Trump in TV appearances be very magnanimous, trying to act presidential. And we've seen him on Twitter basically acting like the candidate calling out critics, picking fights. Which Trump shows up tonight for this rally will be very instructive. If he's acting like he did running for president and kind of, you know, throwing bombs and landing punches on critics, that's much different than you've ever seen a president-elect act before taking office.
That's Scott Detrow, who covers politics for NPR. Scott, thanks so much.
Anytime.
This week, Harvard University President Drew Faust joined a long list of college leaders pledging to take steps to protect students in the country illegally. This is, of course, in response to Donald Trump's promise to overturn President Obama's moves to protect those students from deportation, and Trump's pledge to defund some student aid programs for students who are not legal residents. Tanya Mosley of Here Now contributor WBUR has the stories of two Harvard students who benefit from government protection, attending college without being deported.
Ilian Meza Pena wants to go home.
My emotions are just running really high right now.
Home to her brother and sister in California, sitting at her mom's dining room table eating her delicious food, playing a game of Lotera with her dad, listening to cumbia music. Home is a place where she doesn't have to explain that even though she's not a legal resident, she feels 100% American. But Meza Pena can't return to California just yet. She has work to do. This is her senior year at Harvard University, and her thesis is due soon.
I hope to be a human rights lawyer in the future.
Election night, Meza Pena says she felt like someone hit the brakes on her life. Every morning since, she and her roommate give each other pep talks before heading out to class. It helps, but she's still stuck.
We, like, found our groove. Like, we were going to the gym. We were, like, getting our work done on time. We were, like... And then
Trump
got elected, and we were like, well, there goes all of our motivation toward academic studies.
That's because Meza Pena and her parents are not legal residents. Her roommate has family members who are also here illegally. When Meza Pena was 3, she and her mom and dad migrated from Mexico and never returned. When she hears President-elect Trump's plans for a wall at the southern border or the massive deportation of the undocumented, she worries that by going to college, she may have put her family in jeopardy.
I'm afraid for my parents. I'm afraid for my parents because they have no protections. They haven't had any protections. And, like, with my application, like, I disclose their information as well. Like, I disclose where we live and where they've been working.
That paperwork she's talking about is the application for protective status under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. DACA, as it's called, allows children brought here illegally to study and work in the United States. All of Meza Pena's information is held by the Department of Homeland Security. Across campus, 20-year-old junior Jin Park plugs in his headphones and blasts his favorite blues music. It's his motivation.
Every day I wake up, it's like the fact that I am here is really amazing.
As an Asian man, Park knows when he walks through campus, people likely have different impressions of who he is and where he comes from.
The thing about being like a Korean undocumented person is people don't really expect you to be undocumented.
The conversation in this country about immigration has focused heavily on the Mexican border. But Park believes that just about everyone who is not a legal resident feels afraid or unsure. When Park was 3, his parents moved from South Korea to Queens, New York, on a work visa. When that expired, they just stayed.
I feel American. Like, I know that to be true because this is my home, right? I grew up here. This is where I made all my friends, and this is where I built a life.
But for the first time, Park's parents are expressing to him that maybe it was a mistake to come to the United States. Since they are not legal residents, they are in many ways marginalized. After 17 years, Park's mother still works at a nail salon, his dad at a restaurant. Post-election, they feel even more unsure about their future. It is that weekly phone call from Park's dorm room at Harvard that reminds both him and his parents that the sacrifice is perhaps worth it.
The fact that they're so proud of me is what keeps them going. So when I tell them, yeah, I know it's hard, like, how are you doing? They say, yeah, it's hard, but you're the reason why we keep going.
I'm going to write that chapter.
More than 5,000 faculty, staff, and students signed a petition requesting Harvard become a sanctuary campus which means it would prohibit Immigration and Customs Enforcement from entering a designated area or the entire campus without a warrant. The university is not officially calling itself a sanctuary campus, but President Drew Faust says Harvard will continue to support students like Jen Park and Ilian Meza Pena. The university will add additional resources, like legal advice, and campus police will not inquire about a student's legal status. Harvard estimates there are somewhere around 40 students who have self-identified as undocumented. And with every one of them, a family uncertain of what comes next. For Here and Now, I'm Tanya Mosley.
As we mark World AIDS Day today, longtime AIDS activist and gay rights advocate Cleve Jones has just published his memoir. Jones worked with San Francisco politician Harvey Milk before he was assassinated. Jones also came up with the idea for the AIDS quilt. His book is called When We Rise. Cleve Jones, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And what an amazing journey you've had, as you tell in this book.
And I'm still standing.
You're still standing. And let's go back to the very beginning, because you were growing up in the 50s and 60s in Arizona as a gay person. It was not easy. It was not something that was widely shared at the time. And you thought about suicide for a while and then decided not to go through with it. Why? What stopped you?
Well, life back then was, you know, very different, and there was almost no information about any kind of sexuality, let alone homosexuality. But I was getting tormented a lot at school, and so when I finally understood that what this word meant, I went and looked it up in my father's library. My father was a psychologist, and, you know, quickly learned that what I was deemed mentally ill and also a criminal offense. So I was very frightened, and I think I'm of that last generation of gay people who grew up not really knowing that if there were other people like us at all. And then one afternoon, hiding out in the school library avoiding the bullies, I happened on the 1971 Year in Review issue of Life magazine, and it had a big story about gay liberation called Homosexuals in Revolt. And that was when I first learned that not only were there lots of people like me, but there was a community and a movement, and there were photographs of all these attractive young men with long hair with their fists in the air fighting the police. And I thought, wow, I got to get out of Phoenix.
And you did. And you went to where there were more people like you.
Yeah, I hitchhiked up to San Francisco.
So how did you meet Harvey Milk?
You know, that's probably the question I am asked most frequently, and I don't remember. Harvey was a character in the neighborhood, and I definitely knew him before I went traveling in Europe and the Middle East and kept in touch. And when I got back in 77, that was when our friendship really deepened as we began to get ready to fight the Briggs Initiative, Prop 6, which would have banned gay people from working in any school district in the state. And Harvey was very much a mentor to me. He was a bit of a father figure since I was still estranged from my real father at that time. And he was one of our leaders and a very inspiring guy. He was also extremely funny, and I enjoyed his company very much and was proud that he saw value in me.
Harvey Milk, of course, was assassinated along with the mayor of San Francisco, and you came upon his body in City Hall. I just want to have you read something for us that you wrote for the one-year anniversary of the assassination of Harvey Milk. It's on page 185, if you could read this. This was a speech that you gave to people in the streets in San Francisco who had gathered.
This speech was actually given on the steps of San Francisco City Hall, overlooking Civic Center Plaza, and this is the last third of the speech. I wonder how many of you here tonight have lost a friend or loved one to suicide. Raise your candles high. How many? I wonder how many of you know a woman who has experienced the pain and terror of rape. Let me see your candles. How many? How many of you have been attacked? How many of you have been beaten by bashers or the police? How many? How many of you have heard the taunting cry from behind, "Hey, faggot! Hey, dyke!" How many? That is why we are here tonight. That is why we marched on Washington. That is why we will keep on marching. That is why Harvey lived. That is why Harvey died. That is why we will not rest until Harvey's dream is fulfilled, when lesbians and gay men of every age, race, and background come out to join in the struggle with all of us who seek lives of freedom and dignity and joy. It will be a long struggle. There will be decades of campaigns and leaders and no doubt many martyrs. But let no one misunderstand. Our movement is powered by the determination of a people too long denied, too long abused, a people who seek only the freedom to live, to work, and to love. Let no one misunderstand. We are deadly serious. We grow daily in power, and we will not be stopped. That is why we are here tonight.
As you read that, does it take you back to the time you read it for the first time?
Well, it certainly takes me back to that night, but it also seems to me to be something of a foreshadowing of what was to come, the reference to martyrs. When I wrote those words, I was just assuming that there would be other leaders who would be assassinated, as Harvey was, possibly even myself. But of course, I didn't know that the virus we now call HIV was already in my own bloodstream that night and in the bodies of so many of the people who were standing in Civic Center Plaza, most of whom did not survive.
Well, and in fact, you yourself came very close to not surviving. How did it happen that you turned the corner like that and got better, and you're here to talk to us today?
Well, really, I begin the book by saying that the movement saved my life, and that's not hyperbole. I was ready to kill myself when I was 15, and I read about gay liberation in Life magazine, and I flushed those pills down the toilet. And I came very close to dying, but thanks to the efforts of ACT UP and Project Inform and great heroes like Larry Kramer and Martin Delaney, I was able to access medications. I don't think I would have lived another 6 months if I hadn't gotten into that first clinical trial. So that's the point of this book, is to show that the movement saves people's lives.
Do you think that the marches and rallies and speeches are still a big part of the movement, or should be a big part of the movement? Is people like you putting to words what you feel need to be said in order to take the movement to the next level?
Well, that's a very good question, and I suppose I have a different answer for that than I would have had before this most recent election. I believe that everything we have achieved could be swept away in the blink of an eye. So this is not a time for complacency or self-congratulations. We've achieved some remarkable progress, but we need to understand that none of this is permanent. And history just gives us too many examples of people who thought they were free and woke up one morning and discovered that they were not, and discovered soon after that they were going to have to fight or die. I believe that the movement is more necessary now than ever.
And it doesn't seem like you have very much faith in the younger generation of gays and lesbians to do the kind of work that you and your peers did.
Oh, no, to the contrary. I think that young people today, the millennials, the young people coming up, regardless of their sexual orientation or gender identity, I think are facing a lot of challenges, and I have great empathy for that and concern for them. I worry that those who have grown up under the Obama years don't really understand how strong they're going to have to be. I believe that this election is a catastrophe, not only for LGBT people, but for the country and for the world. I do not think I will live long enough to see the damage undone. And I think that young people today need to prepare themselves for the possibility of having to cope with this and struggle against this for the rest of their lives.
How important do you think the AIDS quilt is now, so many years after you came up with the idea for it?
Well, to be honest, I think the AIDS quilt has been largely forgotten. It's been living in a warehouse in Atlanta for a long time and is rarely seen because the death rate has gone down so dramatically. And so I'm grateful for that the need for the quilting bees that were going on all over the country and around the world, that has diminished. But it concerns me because of this trait we have in this country of not knowing our own history. And the quilt was there at a particular moment in time when it was necessary, and it certainly did its work. I feel quite confident when I say that that quilt played a very important role in reducing the stigma associated with AIDS.
What was it like for you to go back over your entire life like this? And you talk at one point about dumping a box of photographs out. I wonder if that helped you even write this book because you could remember what happened at certain moments. But what was it like to go back over your life and relive all of these moments?
Well, that really began in 2008, working with Dustin Lance Black and Gus Van Sant on the film Milk. Dustin Lance Black came to visit me. I was living in Palm Springs at the time, where I'd gone to sort of retreat and retire and try to regroup. But I'd been sick for a very long time, and I was exhausted. And I was also, honestly, very depressed because almost everybody I loved the most had died, and I missed them. And so Dustin Lance Black and Gus Van Sant required me to go through those boxes of old photographs and tell those stories. And then the film came out, and suddenly all these young people wanted to hear from me. It was like being exhumed. And I decided then that I needed to go back to San Francisco, that I apparently was not going to die soon, and that if I had more time left, I should use it, and I should go back to the place where I most belong and the place I love the most. So it was a process of getting, you know, re-engaged with the movement and, most importantly, getting back to my roots. And my roots are on Castro Street in San Francisco, California.
Cleve Jones, whose new memoir is called When We Rise, My Life in the Movement, a great read. And thank you so much for joining us once again, Cleve Jones.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And the NFL kicks off its weekend with a game tonight between the Dallas Cowboys and the Minnesota Vikings. And the sound you're hearing is a cheer from all football fans because it should be a good game. The Cowboys are one of the top teams in the league this season, led by two outstanding rookies, quarterback Dak Prescott and running back Ezekiel Elliott. The team's on a 10-game winning streak after losing their season opener. The Vikings are 6-5, and they won't have their star running back Adrian Peterson tonight. He's out with a knee injury. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. So, Mike, why is everybody cheering? Why will it be interesting? Because it sounds lopsided.
Well, the records would indicate as such, but the Vikings are clawing for life and the Cowboys are ascendant. Why is it interesting? The answer is probably that second team I mentioned, the Cowboys. They're the most compelling team in football because their quarterback, we talked about this, Tony Romo, got hurt and the rookie wasn't supposed to be good, but Prescott excelled. Then Romo comes back, cedes the position. So that's some human drama that everyone can relate to. But also the Cowboys are, I don't know if they're beloved, but people can't not watch them. Their game against the Steelers set a record for the most watched game this year. And then their Thursday, Thanksgiving Day game, the most watched regular season game in Fox football history. So people want to watch the Cowboys and against a pretty good Vikings team that could represent a defense. Look, Thursday Night Football has been in the doldrums this year. There's been some talk about even killing off the franchise. The NFL denies this. This is the first anticipated Thursday night game in a long time.
Well, maybe the NFL should do something like change its name to the Cowboys and other teams in the NFL because the ratings are so down. I mean, when you say that you have these record nights for just that one team, I mean, you talk about pulling the Thursday night games. It, you know, despite the Cowboys, how in trouble is the NFL because of the ratings?
Right, like the Cowboys and Friends, like Ringo Starr used to tour with the Ringos and Friends. It's so bad. The games have not been competitive. They make the teams wear these horrible, garish pajamas. But I really do think even if the Thursday games, and they haven't been close, even the matchups sometimes aren't compelling. And then when you say, oh, maybe these two teams will give us a good game, they never do. But I will say this. The worst thing about Thursday night football, and I don't mind it in general or as a principle, is it does diminish the specialness of, say, Monday night football. And there was a time when Rune Arledge of ABC invented Monday Night Football. It was Monday Night Football. And now it's like, Monday Night Football. You hear the difference? It's just, wait, is it Sunday night? Oh, that's the Monday Night Football instead of Monday Night Football. and the Monday night ratings are terribly off. Yeah. So yeah, you know, a lot of successful franchises like Starbucks overexpand and maybe they got to pull it back. But like I said, the NFL says they're not going to do that. They're committed to Thursday night.
Okay, real quick, baseball. The owners and the players union reached a tentative agreement last night, new collective bargaining agreement, 5-year deal, takes them through 2021. Did you ever think there was going to be a strike or a lockout?
I did not. The two reasons there is labor strife is because workers have nothing to lose or have a lot to gain, and neither was the case in this situation. And so it was just wise to have more labor peace and to make everyone reap the rewards of it. And the only thing I think that the layman will see is that All-Star game, the winner won't get to host the World Series. That's a relic that's gone now.
Okay, we'll live. Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Thousands of foreign fighters from Britain, from Germany, a few from the U.S., have traveled to Iraq or Syria to join the ISIS cause. In Europe, hundreds have returned, many proclaiming disillusionment. But how many are still committed? Well, a new report produced by German authorities offers some insight, and it's disturbing. The report found that almost half do remain committed to ISIS extremist ideology and remain in touch with extremists. Peter Neumann is a professor of security studies at King's College in London. He's read the report. He joins us by Skype. And Peter, start by giving us some statistics. How many fighters are we talking about who've gone back and forth?
The Germans are talking about 800 in total. About a third of them have already returned to the country. Half of them are still in theater, and maybe about 15% have died.
Well, and some people might say, let's get rid of this question, which I'm sure is coming up. How is it that you just get to go fight for ISIS and come back? You may be indicted once you get back for having fought with ISIS, but you can come back if you have a passport.
So, yes, if you're a German citizen and you have a German passport, the German government cannot deny you entry into your country. So you can come back. But of course, you risk alerting to the authorities that you were in Syria and you have fought for a foreign terrorist organization, which is a crime under German law. And indeed, almost all of them have been indicted under this law.
Well, and tell us about the sense that this report gives of how many give up their identification or their support of ISIS. I mean, what is their mindset when they come back?
It says that a little bit less than half of them are still to some extent committed to the jihadist ideology, even though amongst them there are some who are no longer supporting ISIS. So they are still jihadists. They are still basically believing in the idea of a caliphate, but they have given up on the Islamic State and the caliphate that they have created. Of the remaining 50%, the picture is mixed. About 10% are described as disillusioned. They've completely given up on the ideology as a result of the experience in the so-called caliphate. And 25%, and that's really astonishingly high figure, 25% are collaborating with the authorities.
But how do authorities know to trust that? If so many returnees, according to this report, still support the ideology, which was a surprise to a lot of people, how can you trust those who say they don't and are willing to collaborate?
Of course, ultimately, you cannot trust that in all cases. But every police agency in every country in the world works with informers and former criminals, and they will have to come to a judgment as to whether they can trust that person or whether they can not trust that person but still think that person is so useful to us they can use it for a while.
Well, and talk about those who are still supporting the ISIS cause. That's not illegal. Just to have a mindset is not illegal, is it?
In Germany, it's a bit different from the United States. So you do have hate crime laws, and you also have symbols that are being banned. So ever since West Germany was founded, for example, the swastika was banned as a symbol. And recently, they've also added things like the ISIS flag and other symbols that are associated with ISIS. So if people are displaying these symbols, and if they engage in forbidden speech, then they can be indicted. And you can rest assured that many of them are being monitored, but others are just moving in their old communities. And of course, that's a huge question. Do they pose a risk? How dangerous are they to society? And what capacities does law enforcement intelligence need in order to be able to monitor all these people? Because we're talking about a very significant number.
Well, and this is going to enrage some people. As you well know, the mood around the world is not one of patience with people who have even flirted with terrorists. And again, according to the report, only 10% of all the returnees are disillusioned. 8% may only have come back because they needed to recover from fighting and they want to go back to Syria. Mm-hmm. I can hear people hearing that stat and saying, why are they allowed to be going to their communities? Why is it a tracking system? Why aren't they thrown into jail?
Yeah, that's indeed a big question. And it hasn't really dawned on a lot of people. And by the way, the situation is the same in Britain. It's the same in France, in all of the European countries that have been dealing with that phenomenon, that actually the number of returnees compared to the number of trials that are currently going on is very big. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems that a lot of European countries, even larger European countries like Germany, have is that the court system quite simply does not have the capacity to instigate 270 terrorism trials at the same time. And so it may well be the case that a lot of people will be brought before courts, but there is not the capacity to perform all of these trials at the same time. So for some time, a significant number of these people will be out, maybe on bail, maybe not even being charged. And it will take some time until the court system can process them. And that's even more pronounced in countries like Belgium, which have even smaller capacity in that area.
So, Peter Neumann, we're assuming that this report detailing how many returning ISIS recruits returning to countries like Britain and Germany, how many still support extremist ideology, we're assuming that this report caused some unease in Europe.
Yes. The attacks in Paris and Brussels were carried out by people who had returned. And people, I think, don't necessarily fully realize how widespread and how systematic the returns have already been. Mm-hmm. Across Europe, we're talking about essentially 35%, over a third of people who have fought, who have by now returned to their home countries. And as the core territory in Syria and Iraq crumbles, I think those numbers are likely to increase.
That's Peter Neumann, Professor of Security Studies at King's College London. Professor, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yesterday's deal by OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, to cut oil production by 1.2 million barrels a day hinged on other non-OPEC countries agreeing to also cut production, countries like Russia, which also said it would reduce its current output by as much as 300,000 barrels a day, although it's unclear how these cuts will be implemented. For decades, OPEC has set global oil prices by such controls of supply, but that idea didn't actually start with OPEC. As Mose Bouchel of Here and Now Contributor KUT reports, the idea began in Texas.
It was back in the 1930s when a massive oil field opened up in East Texas. It seemed like a boon to the industry, but then,
as the flood of oil from East Texas drove prices down, oil became cheaper than water, 10 cents a barrel.
That's audio from the 1985 documentary Wildcatter, a story of Texas oil. It tells the crazy story of the oil boom back then, when overproduction flooded the U.S. market.
Major producers, seeing their profit margins cut, turned to the state for protection.
The agency they turned to was the Railroad Commission of Texas, a state agency originally set up to regulate the rails. In order to stop prices from falling, the Railroad Commission ordered smaller oil producers to stop pumping so much. They refused, so Texas Governor Ross Sterling declared East Texas to be in a state of insurrection.
He declared martial law and sent National Guard troops to shut the field down. Oil prices would rise, some said, at the point of a bayonet.
And rise they did, all because oil production in the U.S. was regulated. That went on for decades. The Railroad Commission, working with other states, controlled production with the effect of controlling prices through the 1960s. Sound familiar?
OPEC was explicitly modeled on the Texas Railroad Commission.
That's University of Texas government professor David Prindle. He wrote a book on the Railroad Commission. He says the Railroad Commission model began to spread in the 1950s when the oil minister of Venezuela decided that if Texans could regulate oil supply, so should other producers.
He hired the chief engineer of the Railroad Commission, named Jack Baumel, to come to Venezuela and show him and then show the oil minister of Saudi Arabia how it was done.
And OPEC soon followed. The Railroad Commission still regulates oil in Texas, but the rise of OPEC marked the end of the commission's power over prices, in part because OPEC controls more market share. Yesterday's agreement by members of OPEC will cut global oil output by roughly 1% to bring prices back up, but it's unclear how much that will matter. Now that the U.S. produces so much shale oil, Some analysts think OPEC's lost a lot of its ability to set global production levels. For Here and Now, I'm Mose Bouchal.
On Sunday, Italy will vote on a referendum to reform the country's constitution and trim the legislature. It's a change proposed by the Prime Minister, Matteo Renzi, and the Prime Minister has said he will step down if his constitutional reform measure fails, drawing parallels to the UK's Brexit vote, which led to the resignation of British Prime Minister David Cameron in July. There are also concerns that a no vote could have political and economic ripples across Europe. Joining us now is Lorenzo Codogno, who is the founder of LC Macro Advisors and former chief economist at the Italian Treasury Department. He's also a visiting professor at the London School of Economics. Welcome.
Thanks a lot, and I'm happy to be here.
Well, what exactly would this referendum do, first of all?
Well, the referendum is about a major constitutional change, which basically is supposed to make lawmaking easier and more effective, and at the same time regulate the relationship between the central government and the local government. Having said that, the issue is very complicated, so effectively it will be like a confidence vote on the government.
And it would cut down the number of legislators dramatically in Italy.
Yeah, if yes passes, yes. The Senate would be slimmed down to 100 members of parliament, and the lower house would have most of the powers in terms of lawmaking.
Matteo Renzi, the prime minister, talked about why he wants to do this on 60 Minutes on CBS over the weekend. Let's listen.
This referendum is not a referendum to change democracy in Italy. It's a referendum to reduce bureaucracy in Italy. Italy is the worst country for bureaucracy around the world. And this is very important. If we have a system with a lot of politicians, the consequence is 63 government changes in 70 years.
Lorenzo Codogno, what do you make of that? Do you buy that this would really reduce Italy's bureaucracy and get the economy moving again?
Well, he used the term bureaucracy. Actually, what he meant is that it would make lawmaking more effective, which effectively means that instead of having two houses which have equal power, and therefore any piece of legislation would bouncing back between one house and the other, and with a proposed change, the lower house would become the lawmaking house, and the upper house would be a kind of smaller house representing local government and with limited power. So it would indeed streamline what is now a dysfunctional lawmaking activity.
Megan Green, the chief economist at Manulife Asset Management, told CNBC on Tuesday that a no vote could kick off another banking crisis in Italy, which is the third largest economy in the eurozone. Do you buy that? And what about people who say not just Italy, but all of Europe could be in big trouble if this fails?
If it is a no vote, I see two scenarios. Probably Renzi will resign, the president of the republic will reject his resignation, and then he will be sent back to parliament. If there is a majority in parliament, he will continue. Otherwise, I think the default scenario is that Italy will have a kind of grand coalition in order to reform the electoral law and prepare for the next elections, which are scheduled in spring 2018. I think the extreme scenarios of early elections, prolonged political instability, or even the exit from the euro that someone suggested, I think are very extremely low probability events.
What about the economic ramifications? If this fails, are we going to see a lot of turmoil in the markets?
I think a no vote is pretty much priced in, and so I think limited negative reactions. I think the negative reaction could become bigger if, say, within 2 weeks we don't see a clear solution to the issue of having another government. The issue here is very much related to the banking sector because, as you know, there is Monte Paschi and other banks that are about to ask capital to the market. And without the government, they don't dare to do it, because if the capital increase by Monte Paschi fails, there would be no other solution but some government money injection. And if there is no government, that could clearly be more difficult. So I think any capital increase would be postponed in case of a no vote, which would basically run some risks. I don't think it's a particularly high as a risk, but we have to acknowledge that there is some risk to financial stability in Italy because of that.
And what about politically? We know that Renzi has been fending off challenges from a populist anti-establishment party called the Five Star Movement. Yeah. Who are they and what do they want and what's at stake for them here?
Well, you know, the political system in Italy is a little bit messed up because it's no longer a kind of two-party system. It's becoming tripolar, okay, because you have the central right, the central left, and then you have the five-star movement who nobody knows for sure what they stand for. They are very much a protest movement. They are very much anti-establishment. They are anti-euro to some extent. And so it's difficult to see what they would really stand for. The good news is that they won in the municipality of Rome and in Turin, so they have a chance to prove what they stand for. So we will see.
So, Lorenzo Codogno, it doesn't sound like you're too worried about this referendum.
I'm not particularly worried about political stability, but I'm a bit worried about the combination of temporary political instability with the difficult and delicate situation in the banking sector.
That's Lorenzo Codogno, who is founder of LC Macro Advisors and former chief economist at the Italian Treasury Department. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.